I play to win, and I am win. I play to win, and I am win. That's kind of a backward statement. This is Dr. Herbert L. Byerly, Dean of the University of Healing here in Capo, California, bringing you the thought for today. I play to win, and the word M should have been out of there. I win. I play to win, and I win. Now, why would we ever want to play to win? What benefit would it come to us to play to win? So many times, we play to lose. We direct our life on, oh, that's too good to be true. I can't believe it. You know, that sort of nonsense. And we're delighted, of course, but we say to the other, thank God it works. And there are a number of other statements that we use which indicate our incredulity. And we're incredulous about so many things, and we don't really realize it. You don't say. Yes, Ellen is going to come for lunch. You don't say. And you mean, oh, I'm delighted. I'm surprised and delighted and happy, but you don't say. We say something like that, and it goes contrary to the positive point of view that we want to have. Now, how do we treat ourselves, train ourselves, learn ourselves, whatever the condition may be, to be positive under all circumstances? Well, if we really play to win, we'll be positive under all circumstances. As I've used the illustration of Ellen and her tennis playing, Ellen said, well, this is my day. I'm going to win today. And her opponent looks at her and says, oh, no, no, I'm going to win. The opponent already lost. The opponent said, no, 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 I'm going to win. And we read that article, that little statement about the archery contest, you know. And in the archery contest, the contest was to shoot the eye out of a fish up on a pole, quite high. And everyone had to shoot the eye out of the fish, or, you know, shoot the arrow in the eye, at least. And every one of the contestants missed, and they were asked, did you aim? Oh, yes, yes, I could see the fish up there. I could see his tail. I could see his head. I could see everything. Next one missed. Oh, yes, I could see everything. Next one. Same with all of them. And then one young man came out, and he had his bow and arrow. And they said, and, son, what do you see? I see the eye of the fish. And he shot directly to it, and he won. Now, he didn't say, I see the whole fish, I see this, I see that. He was not confused as to what his target was. You and I oftentimes are confused as to what our target is. We think that we're supposed to be all knowledgeable, all aware of everything. We're supposed to be aware of whatever it is we want to be aware of when we want to be aware of it. And that is a very definite condition. Because if you're not, then you're not very wonderful. Later I talk about Susan. But Susan is a girl who is a rather remarkable lady. When she walks into a room, no one really notices her. They notice her because she's a nice lady, but she will instantly choose to talk to people. And when she talks to people, she talks right to them. She looks at them. She talks to them. She listens to them. And when you're done talking with Susan, you think that you have just been on the mountaintop. You've just had a breath of fresh, pure air. Now, she was one-pointed. And being one-pointed, she accomplished the goal that she chose. And the goal that she chose was to be interested in whoever she spoke to, whether it was a little child, whether it was a dog or a cat. She gave them 100% of her attention, and the animal or the person or the circumstance thoroughly enjoyed 100% of her attention and reveled in it. Now, you see, how can a circumstance revel in 100% attention? Well, if you give 100% attention to dusting, you're going to dust beautifully, aren't you? If you give 100% attention to making your meal, you're going to make a very excellent meal. You're going to make a meal that is tasty and delicious. And you're going to make a meal with variety and imagination and all that sort of good stuff. But if you're just going to throw something together, my mother would say, I'm just going to throw something together for supper. Well, she didn't know how to do that. Whenever mother made a meal, she made a meal with imagination. She had to. She didn't have everything to make a meal with, because much of the time, as we were growing up, it was, so to speak, hard times. Money wasn't available, food wasn't available, many things weren't available because the country had experienced a depression, and they experienced a downtrend. But mother still made it. She threw things together. When she would throw together a bread pudding, it would be the most delicious bread pudding you could ever imagine. It wasn't always the same. Sometimes it would have raisins in it, sometimes it would have nuts in it, sometimes it always had bread. It always had the stale bread. And unfortunately, when we were growing up, we didn't learn that the crust is good. So she had lots of crust to make her bread pudding out of, and it was very good. But I think it's too bad that we don't teach children that the crust is really great. It's like a pretzel, you know, or like a potato chip, or like a French fried onion. I mean, kids love French fried things. They love this here. And we teach them not to eat the crust. We teach them not to do it. And we cut the crust off for them and all these silly things. But they are a living example of our hang-ups. They're a living example of our attitudes. They have to be, because we're their parents. We train them. So if a child has a bad attitude about bread with a crust on it, bad, I say, because it's good, it's from his parents. You say, his parents eat the bread with a crust on. Well, somewhere he got it. Somewhere he was trained into it. He didn't come up with that idea all by himself. You can be sure of that. Neighbor boy, neighbor girl, somebody else, cousin, relative of some sort. But somebody told him that. We have to be so careful what goes into our thinking. If we're going to win in life, we have to have winning attitudes about ourselves at all times. And then we win. We don't have a winning attitude about ourselves when we are in competition with somebody else. We can't. Because we're going to be looking at the whole fish instead of at the eye. When we're in competition with somebody else, we're going to say, I can outdo him. Well, you don't outdo anybody. You just do your best. You be your fabulous best, which nobody can match. Nobody wants to match it because they don't even think of matching it. But be your fabulous best, whatever that may be. Now, a lot of times, we are so proud of ourselves for doing things. Now, Ingeborg was telling us, she went over to the Oasis, I think it was, and she watered the flowers there, right? And when she watered the flowers, they were saying thank you to her and stuff like that. Now, why did Ingeborg tell us that she was watering the flowers? Basically, because she thought she was doing something wrong. If Ingeborg goes to the toilet, she didn't tell us about that. If Ingeborg sits at the table and eats her food, she didn't tell us about that. If Ingeborg takes nice care of her clothing and sews them nicely and keeps them in good condition and stuff, she didn't tell us about that. But she told us about watering the flowers because she felt that the flowers needed water and they weren't getting it. and she wanted us to feel guilty that the flowers weren't getting the water. Now, she doesn't win by doing that. Now, why am I making such a fuss over this? Because these are things that we are dealing with every day. We go and do things because it's fun to do it. We go and do things because we delight in doing them. If you don't like watering the flowers, don't water them, you know. If you think watering the flowers is somebody else's job, don't do it. And if you think that watering the flowers is lots of fun, go for it. Now, Ellen thinks that answering the telephone is a lot of fun.
And you probably want to do it.
What?
You probably want to always answer.
See, now she's making excuses for what she's doing.
Yeah.
And you see, when she makes excuses for what she's doing, she's not a winner. Now, why am I making this statement about Ellen? Because we have a house full of telephones here. We have a telephone virtually in every room. And she jumps up and runs out of the room to answer the phone. Basically because she hasn't got it plugged in here. And in here alone, we have two phones that are just waiting there to be answered. One is a phone that will be on both lines and so forth. Now, why weren't they plugged in? Why weren't they functioning? And they weren't functioning because it just got forgotten. You understand? The plants at the oasis just got forgotten. And then you feel guilty about it. But you cannot win when you feel guilty. When you feel guilty, whenever the phone rings, Ellen, and we'll let Ingeborg answer this. Whenever the phone rings, what happens, Ingeborg?
Somebody picks it up.
But you almost had it right. Somebody is there. Whenever the phone rings, there's someone on the other end. We have recently had a number of calls that come in, and then there's nobody there. Because they hear an American voice, or they hear a Swiss voice, or they hear whatever, and they say, that's not my mama, I got the wrong number, you know. And so then they hang up without saying, hey, I'm sorry, I misdialed, you know. And so you don't know why they misdialed, you don't know, you don't care. But Ellen is putting a cause in motion now that every time she answers the phone, someone is there. She's going to be a winner. Every time she answers the phone, someone is there. Every time she answers the phone, someone is there. Now, Sylvia, what's the next statement she says about the phone?
It only rings when I want it to ring.
That was the next one I was going to come up with there later. But the phone only rings when I want it to ring. When you're sitting at your desk, or you're available to answer it comfortably, the phone rings. The phone doesn't ring while you're in the middle of a lecture, while you're in the middle of meditation or introspection. The phone doesn't ring while you're doing something like that. What happens when the three of you are sitting here and the phone rings and you're in introspection? Do you answer the phone? Bitte?
No.
No. So why do you create the phone ringing when you're in introspection? You're not going to answer it. So don't create it ringing. You're the winner. You're the creator of everything in your world. No matter what it is, don't create it. Now, at 7:20 every evening, just as we are finishing our supper and so forth, the phone rings. Sometimes it's a person and sometimes not. And it is not usually an important call. Okay? Now, we have another thing we want to be a winner about. These telemarketing people call a great deal, although I must admit I think they're calling less now. And when they call, I place in my consciousness that when they call, they immediately identify themselves. Hello, this is Patrick of the San Diego Tribune. And I say, Patrick, it's so nice you to call. Thank you very much. I'm not interested in taking the paper right now. Goodbye. And I don't wait for him to say anything, because he has said what he had to say. And then I say what I want to say, and there's no conversation. I don't know the fellow. I don't owe him a conversation. I feel I owe him a statement as to what I recognize he's going to ask me to do, and then I just tell him. Now, as I say, he's not a bad guy. He's just doing his job. But I am even more intelligent. I win even more when I say to myself, I am free of all telemarketing calls. Are you going to buy anything when someone calls you on the telephone, basically? No. It's a pain in the neck. It's a bother. It's a inconvenience. And so why not just create it not happening? Or create the phone ringing only with our friends and students. Or would-be students. Would-be friends. But only with people who want to know about us. Or who want to talk to us.
Share their abundance with us.
And share their abundance with us. Now, when Ingeborg's answering the phone, she picks it up. And she says, well, sis, how are you? And her sister's calling her from Germany, right? And she's saying, well, Ingeborg, it's so nice to talk to you. Why don't you call me once in a while? It's so nice to talk to you. Do you know what my son's doing now? His wife's pregnant already, you know? They just got married a short time ago, and man, she's, you know, ready to have, she's got it in the oven already, and that's great. And Ingeborg says, oh, wow, what are you going to name him? Name him? We don't even know yet, you know. Maybe it's going to be one, maybe it'll be a dozen, you know. I tell you, if they can have more than the normal, maybe they'll get the government to pay for raising the kids, you know, because they got so many. But no, we want everything in happy, normal circumstances. You know how difficult it is to try to love a dozen children all at once? You can't. You have to love each one separately. So that's why our bodies are basically tuned to have one at a time. So we can love the little critters while they're coming up, while they're awakening to their divine being that's within them. And we show them how to open up and be that divine self. Now, this is the winner. Now you say, well, those don't sound like very spiritual things. Well, they certainly are very spiritual things. Because everything is spiritual. And when we say, it's merely somebody's desire, it's merely this or it's merely that, we are belittling the divinity that we are. Everything is divine. And winning is divine. Now, we read this little item from Victoria on the internet this morning about the three gods, about the three guys who were out fishing in the boat. And Jesus came walking across the water and asked if he could get in the boat. And he said, well, sure. So one fellow says, Jesus, will you heal me? I was injured in Vietnam and I have a back injury, which is not very pleasant. And Jesus said, well, of course. And he laid his hand on him and the fellow felt like he'd never felt in his life. Totally wonderfully healed. And the next fellow wore heavy glasses. And Jesus looked at him, and the fellow says, I'd like to be able to see better. And so Jesus took his glasses and threw them in the ocean, in the water, wherever they were. And the moment the glasses hit the water, the man could see perfectly. And then the other man, Jesus said, well, and what about you? And he says, no, I don't want to change it, I'm on total disability. And so he didn't have his total healing. He's on total disability. He didn't want to give up the illness or injury or whatever he had that allowed him to be total disability. You have to have quite a bit wrong with you to be total disability. And so he wanted that money that came into him every day of the week and every day of the month and every day of the year for all the years of the rest of his life. He didn't want wholeness and perfection. We don't either. We don't either. When we consider ourselves a loser, when we don't go into everything we go into as a winner, we don't want these things either. We don't want these experiences in our life because these experiences in our life are very tough. They're very tough. Just think, if you were on total disability and then you were totally able to do it, And you'd have to get a job. You'd have to go to work. You'd have to take care of yourself and your family and your world. Take responsibility. You can't be a vegetable anymore. Now, people on total disability, it's interesting. I know my brother is going through an experience, and the experience he's going through, he's not treating it like total disability. He's saying, well, since I can't see too good, I'm going to start doing things that let me see. I'm going to learn Braille. I'm going to have these books that are read to you, you know, on tape and stuff. I'm going to do these things, and I'm going to memorize my house. I know it. I mean, I've lived in it for years, but I'm going to memorize. He didn't want to give up living. Now, because he doesn't want to give up living, he can very readily have his sight. He can very readily take the healing that is his to have. What would you do? You say, well, I'd want to see. I'd want to do it. No, you wouldn't. When you are conditioned to a circumstance, you're conditioned to it. And you're not really ready to take responsibility for yourself. And so, what's the first thing that happens? You go downhill. We look at the old folks' home or the rest homes, and we say, gee, those poor guys, they're sitting in their wheelchairs, lying in their beds, there's nothing for them. And then somebody goes in there, and they bring their puppy or their cat along or whatever, and they let the people play with the cat or the puppy. And all of a sudden, oh, hey, oh my, you know, they come alive. Now, you would think that these rest homes would be loaded with pets. You know? I mean, that's the best medicine they could get. But no, it's a bother to take care of the pets and to take care of these old people who can't take care of themselves. They're incontinent, you know. And, hey, that should be a part of the healing. It's a cheaper medication than a lot of these pills that they have to give them. For goodness sakes. And what about you? What about you? We laugh at these ladies and men, these old ladies and old men who have their pet, and they say that that's my child, that's my baby. And they're sparkling and they're full of life and they're dynamic and they're powerful and they're happy. Okay, now, that's the easy part. But people who want to win have to apply a little bit of self direction to it. They say in medical circles that if you can get an elderly person to lift a 1 pound, 2 pound, 5 pound weight maybe 6 times every day, and then increasing it as you go along if you can, that person will add years to their life in healthy years, happy years, years of wholeness. But that, again, is too much of a bother. You have to have all this health equipment around. Then you have to have someone who can show them what to do so they don't overdo it. Because if a little bit of medicine is good, a lot is better. You know how they want to say, if a little exercising is good, a lot would be better. Well, you have to take it in little steps because you've been away from it. But as you start going back, they said that after several months, the musculature of these people increased so beautifully and so wonderfully that they were just, you know, happy with life. They were out of their wheelchairs, in fact. And they wanted to live. But the will to live takes you out of the wheelchair, not the exercise. And the will to live is the will to sit there and do the exercises and to work out. A lot of people who have lost several limbs, they exercise daily, and they run their wheelchairs, and they are running races, and they're in the marathons and things like that. And some of the guys are in their 80s, and they have bad legs and bad this and bad that. With their crutches, they run in the marathon because they don't go far, but they go far enough. They're in the marathon, and they're all dressed up. Gussied up just to fit the kill, you know, and they're going maybe about 50 feet. Super, super. And maybe tomorrow they'll go 60 feet, you know? But it's just a matter of the desire to live, the desire to win, the desire to be a master of yourself. And when you have that desire to be a master of yourself and the desire to win, you win. But without it, it's not a matter that you lose, but you're nothing. You're nothing. You're not even a vegetable. So I suggest to all of us that we have the desire to win. And we win every time, not because we're competing against somebody else, but because we're being our own personal best, our own spiritual best, our own most wonderful best. Have a wonderful day. Know that I'm thinking about you and loving you and seeing you whole and perfect in everything you do all the time.